This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Shell. Today we're interviewing Jesse Austin. He's Assistant Professor of Large Mammal Conservation and Management in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona. He's Special Features Editor of the Journal of Mammalogy and a member of the American Society of Mammalogists. So welcome, Jesse. It's good to be talking to you today. How are things in Arizona?
Pretty good. We got some rain yesterday, and that's always good in the desert.
I guess. How hot is it?
It's not too bad. It's in the high 90s, which is pretty temperate for this time of year.
And you're where?
In Tucson, so in southern Arizona.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, at least you're not lower down in Phoenix. Tucson's a little bit elevated, so.
Yeah, anyway. A little better here.
Well, I was interested in your research methods. Apparently, you use some statistical computations in studying larger animals, and you study their movements and behavior. So would you talk about that? What are your methods?
Yeah, so my research specialty at this point is movement ecology, so studying the ways that animals move across the landscape, how to better statistically quantify that, and then see what we can learn using those methods about ecology. And this has become really data intensive over the past couple decades. So back in the day, 50, 60 years ago, the way folks learned about animal movement was just to individually mark animals and then try to find them again. So you put ear tags on them, like you'd see on maybe a cow these days, and then let them go, and then hopefully you see them again, go out looking for them pretty intensively. And with that sort of thing, you might get an idea of where they are as far as the animal may be. You see them in this valley in summer, and then in the winter that same animal shows up in a valley 20 miles away, and you can get a sense for if animals are moving around or they're staying in the same place, but you really only have like 5 data points. Something like that, maybe 5-10 if you have a pretty good data set. After that, we moved into VHF telemetry. So this was a kind of an older tracking technology where you put a radio collar on an animal, and that radio collar emits a beep, basically, and then you have a little radio and an antenna that tries to pick up a directional signal, so it gets louder if the antenna is pointed in the direction of the animal. And you're really trying to triangulate the animal manually. So you get the directional signal from one area, you get a directional signal from another area, maybe a third or fourth, and then you're trying to see where those lines intersect.
What's your receiver? How do you detect the signal? Do you use cell phone or you have some other device?
Yeah, so it's pretty similar to two-way radio. So it's like a little, well, there's different ones. The ones that I typically use are about the size of a two-way radio, if you ever use one of those, or maybe a big walkie-talkie or the original cell phones, not the tiny ones we have these days. But I've used some that are as big as a car battery and about as, not quite as heavy to carry around, but a big pain to carry around in the woods.
Uh-huh. What kinds of animals are you studying?
I study primarily terrestrial mammals, and I've studied everything ranging in size from mice to elephants. And I have access to data from different researchers all over the world that have been generous enough to share their data. I think we have data from 6 different continents, so all of them except Antarctica. And we study terrestrial mammals because they're relatively easier to study. So aquatic mammals go underwater, so they're missing big chunks of data. If they dive down, it's really hard to triangulate. We can only get locations if they're pretty close to the surface. With animals that fly, you to take into account their movements, you really have to do some more 3D stuff. So not only are they moving in kind of 2 directions in space, but you also have to take into account their altitude. And we do kind of 2 sets of analyses. So one for these really big comparative data sets, we like to look at things like body size and how that shapes movement behavior. So if you think about how a mouse moves, a mouse may move only a few meters, have a really tiny home range, and an elephant may move over, tens of square miles or hundreds of square miles even. And then we have some studies that are on specific species. So I'm working on a couple papers right now, one on bobcats here in Tucson. So we want to know how they're interacting with roads, and one on anteaters in Brazil on the Cerrado, which is kind of a dry savanna. And there we want to know if they're using specific features of landscape to better deal with the effects of heat and see if climate change might change their movements.
So it's just mammals that you're studying. You don't check birds or reptiles or any other kinds orders of animals?
Yeah, for the most part. So my expertise in actually knowing the biology of these animals is mostly with mammals, but if a bird expert or a snake expert comes up to me with an interesting data set, I'm happy to help them analyze the data too. I just don't know as much about the biology of those species as I do about mammals.
Mm. So do you get out in the field often?
As often as I can, which isn't as often as I'd like to these days. The more you advance in your career, the more time you spend in the office. But when I do get out to go in the field, I often get to go out and do the fun stuff, and I don't have to do the annoying, boring stuff that my graduate students and technicians often get stuck doing.
Are you principally studying mammals down there in the Southwest?
Yeah, my local research and all of my graduate students will be working with mammals. Most of them here in Arizona, although I do some international work as well.
Mm-hmm. So the kinds of statistical data you're collecting are movements and what else? Longevity of life forms or what?
Yeah, we can get longevity too. So earlier I mentioned this, the individual marking and the VHF telemetry. We've kind of moved past that these days into GPS telemetry. And so we'll stick devices on animals. They'll give us a little GPS signal. Usually it's kind of a fixed duration. So every 15 minutes maybe for a big animal like a moose.
Mm-hmm.
It might be every hour for a deer. For small animals, it might be, once a day or something like that. And so the animal is kind of moving consistently, but we're only getting a snapshot of its location at a given interval. And for larger animals, another reason I study the larger animals is because they can hold a bigger battery, which means we can collect more data on them.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we want to know really fine-scale movements. What are they doing? How is their movement behavior changing every 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes? Over the course of a day. And sometimes we want to monitor their more longer-term movements, or if we're really interested in survival, we can extend that and have a collar stay out. Instead of a few months, we can have it stay out for 2, 3, 4 years for some of the larger animals.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can get a real good picture. You can know basically exactly when an animal dies or potentially when an animal gives birth, things like that. And those are sort of supplementary data points you can pick up. A lot of the GPS collars now are also outfitted with the older VHF telemetry devices. So we don't use them for getting locations as much these days. It's going out and trying to get eyes on an animal. So we're mostly collecting the data with the GPS telemetry, but if the animal seems to be doing something really weird, it hasn't moved as much recently, we can go out and see what's going on. And if we want to we can go out during the reproductive season maybe and get eyes to see if it, a deer has a fawn or if it has two fawns, get eyes on them, try to see if they're also surviving along with the mother. And I think that's kind of the new frontier of movement ecology is going to be tying that sort of data to just the dots on the map.
What's involved in the analysis of the data? I assume you record that electronically?
Yeah. So basically we get, with the newer GPS sets of data, we get a spreadsheet of locations. And these can be huge spreadsheets. So with GPS and a new, just emerging type of data called reverse GPS, you might get thousands of locations for an animal or even millions of locations for an animal. And so that takes a lot of computational intensity. So I work with a team that develops a package for the statistical software called R. Our package is called CTMM. And so this was the sort of the brainchild of Justin Calabrese, who's a researcher in Germany, who I used to work for. He hired Chris Fleming about a decade ago. Chris is actually formally trained as a physicist. He studied his PhD is on particle physics. He's a really, really good mathematician, coder. And so Justin and Chris and some other folks really worked to put together this package to analyze data. And the idea here is to fit the same models you would use to describe particle movements, you know, at a really small scale. You can use the same models and see if those models fit animal movement well. And so these are called stochastic process models. So it's a movement process that is stochastic, which means there's some sort of random variation in there. And I think this was a pretty big advance in movement modeling, because the old-fashioned way was to, we have what we call discrete time data, which means we have these little snapshots of data at known points, but we know animals are moving in between there. And the mathematics of this discrete time data get really complicated. Some of the equations are literally impossible to solve. They get really complex real quick. But with these continuous time stochastic process models that Justin, Chris, and some other folks introduced, including Mike Noonan, Ellie Gerardi was involved early on, the computation actually became a little bit simpler. And so once we fit the stochastic process models, find the one that best describes the movement, then we can do all kinds of analyses that are conditional on that best-fitting model. So we can look at their home range, which is where an animal tends to spend its time during the regular course of its life. Habitat selection, so what sorts of landscape features are these animals using and avoiding, how fast they're going, so we can get really accurate speed data. And we can also reconstruct movement paths. So if you have, say, an animal that you know crossed the road, because you have one location on one side of the road and one location on the other, it probably, if you draw a straight line between those points, it probably didn't cross the road right there. If you think about how an animal moves, it's kind of roaming back and forth. But with these continuous time movement models, we can get a good estimate of what the animal's actual path was based on statistics.
And I assume that you transmit the information that you've collected to wildlife agencies, state agencies?
Yeah, so a lot of times, so if it's funded by a certain organization, sometimes it's mandatory that any data we collect be sent to them. We're always submitting reports to let agencies know what we're doing. So they give us a lot of money to do this, and they want to make sure that we're actually doing what we said we would do when they gave us the money. And then we write scientific papers as well to try to disseminate this knowledge to the scientific community, but also to agencies too. They read these papers, and the papers inform management.
So you apparently use thermal physiology. What's that?
Yeah, so thermal physiology is the study of how animals physiologically react to hot and cold temperatures, basically, and how they thermoregulate. So you have kind of the old-fashioned terms are warm-blooded and cold-blooded. A lot of folks know that, snakes, for example, aren't internally regulating their temperature. They have to go out and absorb some solar radiation, some sunlight to heat up in the mornings and get to a temperature where they can be most active. With mammals, we're producing our own heat, and that has some advantages.
Mm-hmm.
It makes us able to go out and do things at temperatures where the exotherms, the species that need to absorb heat from their environment, you know, they can't really go out and be active when it's super cold in the winter. And so this thermal physiology was the topic of my PhD. I studied bats actually doing this, and bats are interesting because they're kind of a mix of these two behaviors. So they're mammals, they can produce their own heat, and so they can go out and be active when it's, you know, a little bit colder outside. But they also, to save energy, they can also kind of turn that off for a little while, so they go into torpor. It's kind of like sleep. It's not exactly the same, but it's even more you shut down more of your organ systems and things to conserve energy. So you're just sitting there really inactive, and you can get lower your body temperature quite a bit.
Conversely, it's been so hot down there. I'm wondering how wildlife reacts to the high temperatures that you've been experiencing.
Yeah, so they can do a couple different things. So most mammals that don't have this option to shut down their body systems and use torpor.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of those species you see, if you have a pet dog, you've seen get panting. It can animals can go to water. It's often, there are some animals that we know go to water and just kind of hang out, like in a swimming pool,
mm-hmm.
Like we might do on a hot day. But a lot of them maybe go to water or even just like lick themselves in the evaporative cooling once they get out of the water, once they have saliva on their forearms. This is what kangaroos do, for example. That can cool them down a little bit. So they can pant like dogs. They can just try to find shady spots. But I think this is kind of a frontier of animal ecology right now, is trying to figure out how animals are dealing with these increasingly hot spells. And we know sometimes they just can't deal with it. So we get mass mortality events. The most famous ones that come to mind are flying foxes in Australia. So it can get really, really, really hot in Australia. They'll have these mass mortality events where there'll be a bunch of flying foxes roosting in a city park or something like that. It gets up to 110, 115 degrees, and the bats literally just fall out of the trees. I've seen videos on YouTube of, you know, somebody walking around just looking at the ground. There's bats flying everywhere. So I think this is a pretty important thing to study and better understand these days. And it's going to vary from animal to animal. Some have better heat tolerances than others. Some have more behavioral ability to deal with heat, and some of them are just going to be in trouble.
Have there been any species down in your area that have succumbed to the heat?
Yeah, there definitely are. I think the most famous examples of this is actually birds. Blair Wolf at the University of New Mexico and some other sort of thermal physiologists have looked at these mass mortality events in birds to look at, you know, how hot does it need to get for lots of birds to just cook, basically. For the larger mammals, we haven't seen it as much yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does happen and we just haven't quite picked up on it yet. They're probably not, there aren't mass die-offs, but I could see, you know, individual animals, especially if they're in bad condition because they're wounded or they have higher parasite loads or something like that. A lot of times those sort of secondary stressors can get you to the point where you're more vulnerable to heat.
Mm-hmm. So you apparently use remote sensing in doing some research. Does that mean collaring animals and tracking them?
Yeah, so remote sensing, GPS collars are a form of remote sensing. But there's lots of other forms too. So the most folks who consider themselves remote sensing researchers are using some sort of data collected mostly from the sky, sometimes from the ground, but via satellite, or increasingly these days people are interested in using drones to get really high resolution data.
Really?
Because when we're, you know, if I'm looking at how an animal is moving across its home range, an animal like a mountain lion, it might move over, you know, hundreds of square miles. That's a really large landscape, and you can't measure every little thing in it. And so we're using satellite-collected data to see how temperature varied across the landscape, how vegetation types vary, infrastructure like roads or buildings, bridges, things like that. And then one type of data that I'm really excited about using and that's really exploded over the past decade or so is LIDAR, which is usually it's collected by a sensor on an airplane. So you fly over a landscape and it shoots a laser at the landscape. And whenever that laser hits something, a tree or the ground or rocks or something like that, a little piece of it bounces back up. And so some of these laser pulses you can get sort of bounce back information from multiple points in each laser beam. And that the amount of time it takes to hit something and then return lets you know how far away it was until it hit something. And so you can get, it's really cool where you get these sort of point cloud maps of little dots where it hit something and returns. And if you look up LIDAR, you can Google LIDAR and see really cool pictures of, in really fine detail of trees, vegetation cover, landscape, elevation, things like that. And for the thermal ecology research I do in particular, that's really cool because we can see was an animal, you know, sitting under particular types of trees, trees with particular characteristics, and things like that. And so I think it's a really, this LIDAR data is a really useful tool that I think we'll be using more and more going forward.
So you belong to the American Society of Mammalogists. Does that organization exist in order to share techniques and study techniques and data?
Yeah, so most researchers are involved with one or more of what we call professional societies. And the main duties of these professional societies are to organize conferences where like-minded researchers get together and talk about their research. And a lot of times this is research that hasn't quite been published yet, so you can publish or you can talk about preliminary research and get feedback from other researchers. Maybe something is even cooler than you thought. Maybe something you did something a little bit wrong, and so somebody with a little bit different mindset can bring fresh eyes on it. These professional societies often usually also publish journals. So the American Society of Mammalogists publishes the Journal of Mammalogy, where I'm one of the editors. They also have a pretty neat journal called Mammalian Species, where basically people publish everything we know about a particular species. It's a really useful resource if you want to know everything you can about any given species for which there's a mammalian species account. Some of the other professional societies that are really big in wildlife biology are the Wildlife Society, Society for Conservation Biology, Ecological Society of America, and then there's other taxonomically focused ones. So there's bird groups, reptile and amphibian groups, fish groups, a bat group, even to be even more specific, mammals. And the thing I like about the American Society of Mammalogists is kind of three things. So one is a lot of the membership is made up of folks who work at museums, which is a very particular slice of researchers that I didn't have that much exposure to before I got involved in society. I hadn't really worked with museums that much. But a lot of times these are the folks that are describing new species, trying to define species. Maybe we split them up too much and we need to lump them back together. And so a researcher at the Field Museum, I remember from our meeting this summer, gave a really interesting talk about certain types of mice in the Philippines that eat mostly earthworms.
Mm.
And so in the Philippines, there's only one species of shrew because they colonized the Philippines relatively late. But there's all these mice that evolved to be very similar to shrews in their sort of body size and shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look like a shrew even though they're mice. And so I thought that was, it's not often these days that I learn about new types of mammals, but I thought that was really cool. The other thing that I really like about the American Society of Mammalogists is it's really generous to early career researchers. And so I got grants from the societies that really helped me do my graduate research. My graduate students are already getting grants from the society. And that's not the case for all the professional societies, but the American Society of Mammalogists is really good at that.
You're co-chair of the African Research Fellowship Committee at the University of Arizona. So do you provide funds for students to study African mammals?
Yeah, so the African Research Fellowship Committee is actually a committee of the American Society of Mammalogists. I'm the co-chair along with Link Olson, who's at the museum at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I think I do a lot of cool stuff, but I think this is one of the coolest things I do. So what the committee does is we give $1,500 grants to African graduate students to do field research on mammals. And so, you know, we're not funding American researchers or European researchers to go work in Africa. We're funding the African students who often don't really have access to much funding. $1,500 may not sound like a lot to a lot of folks, but it really is. So we assessed the program recently to see if this money is making a difference, and looked at things like graduation rates, how often the folks we fund publish their research in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And the folks that we funded have done really, really cool stuff. And I think this is, it's really important to build this local capacity for wildlife research. And so,
what animals have your students been studying in African animals?
Yeah, so we slowly built up the fund we used to fund these grants. And this year, we funded a record number of projects, 7. We'll fund at least 7 next year as well. And so the students we funded a Kenyan student this year who's doing some giraffe conservation work, working with communities to better understand their knowledge and willingness to conserve giraffes. There's a student from Botswana looking at how elephants behave and move around the landscape after they're translocated. A student from Togo who is mapping the illegal pangolin trade in Togo, which is really important. Pangolins are super, super endangered. There's a student in Ethiopia who's looking at small mammal ecology. We have a student from Zambia who is doing large mammal surveys. A bat ecologist in Nigeria who's looking at interactions between bats and their parasites. And then a lemur conservation student from Madagascar. So it's 7 projects, 7 different countries. Some of those countries, especially like Togo, Togolese folks speak French. They often don't have access to English-speaking resources or grants that need to be written in English, but we'll actually allow folks to submit grants in French, and we will translate them into English, evaluate the grants that way, and take that little extra step to go above and beyond that to make sure that these students can get the resources to meet their needs. So there aren't that many peak researchers in Togo. It's a relatively small country, but it also has an incredibly unique fauna. And so we're really excited that we get to fund research in some of these smaller countries that have even less research capacity than a lot of other places in sub-Saharan Africa.
Jesse, we've run out of time, but I have a lot more questions to ask you, so maybe we continue our conversation next week. So our guest today has been Jesse Alston, assistant professor at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can see our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.